Welcome to Holden Village. Today is Wednesday, July 3rd, 2002. This session is a forum entitled, To Whom Do We Pledge Allegiance? Are we one nation under God? Let's listen in.
My name is Kent Burgess, and I'm here as the summer program coordinator along with Barbara Rossing. We're sharing that responsibility this year. I used to live at Holden. I was the business manager here from 1986 through 1990, but I left almost 12 years ago, and it's just great to be back this summer. We're trying to recapture some of history in our 40 years in the wilderness, and one of that is forums throughout the week. Mondays we're rotating three forums, one on Holden food philosophy, one is a peace forum, and the other is a forum on gay and lesbian issues within the church today. So that's happening on Mondays. On Thursdays, we have an open forum, and because of the 4th of July, we've scheduled that for tonight. What we're going to talk about tonight is the recent ruling by the 9th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals that ruled that the Pledge of Allegiance was unconstitutional, or at least the part that says under God. Now, I went to the Holden Internet to research this thoroughly, and so that would be today, the Newsweek that came out. Plus three newspaper articles that Dwayne Lansford gave me that are a week old. So that's as new as the research is. But I thought you might be interested a little bit in the history of the Pledge of Allegiance. It began in 1892 by a preacher, teacher, and editor by the name of Francis Bellamy. And he wrote an original pledge, and it appeared in a family magazine. Leaflets are sent out to schools, and on Columbus Day, 12 million students pledge allegiance to my flag and the republic for which it stands. In 1924, my flag was changed to be the flag of the United States of America. And then in 1943, the Supreme Court holds that schools cannot make the pledge mandatory. And then in 1954, the Knights of Columbus get Congress to add the phrase under God, and that's the phrase that now is in dispute.
Did you say 1954?
1954.
That's correct.
And it required President Eisenhower's signature to make that happen. And now in the year 2002, the panel of the Ninth Circuit ruled that the under God is unconstitutional. I was kind of interested, I was able in one of the editorials that Dwayne gave me to say what, you know, 1954, why did they add the under God? And I just pulled a quote out of the section that was, I talked quite a bit. This writer says, the sole reason that God was added in 1954 was to strengthen the rhetorical contrast between our God-fearing nation and the godless communists. And that was kind of the history. So, in the last 30 hours, I've learned more about the Pledge of Allegiance than I've ever known before. The format tonight is that I'm going to give some opening remarks, and then I've got two wonderful folks who volunteer, Dale Hilliard, who is a retired school teacher, and Eric Landsberg, who is an attorney in Seattle. I've asked them to kind of speak to the issues as they see them. Know that neither one of these brave volunteers hold great passion for the argument or what they're going to present. And so I have great respect that they're willing to do that. And our hope is to basically just lay some stuff out there that we can then engage in an intelligent conversation. I'm afraid one of the things I've loved about Holden is that I think it's one of the few places that I experience where we actually have intelligent conversation. I hope that we can create some tension in this conversation, because I know in talking to people in the last day and a half, there is a fair amount of tension over this issue. And I'm not going to frame, I think there are a lot of issues here, but these are the conversations that I've had. And I think they boil down to at least the conversations I've had with folks in the village as I try to recruit volunteers. Was that there are really kind of three issues here and then two subplots that I'm calling to those issues. And so I'm hoping our conversation can somewhat center around these issues, but I expect that we will vary from them to some degree. The first kind of major plot is, was the Ninth Court's decision a good decision or a bad decision? That's fairly simple. And as far as I can tell from what I've read, that's all that's really being debated in our society today. And from most of what I've read is the folks are standing up saying this was a bad decision, and politicians are climbing over each other to try to be the first to prove that that's a bad decision. However, in talking to many of you, I sense that there is a subplot to that. And the subplot goes something like this. Should we pledge or not pledge with or without under God? And there's been some conversation I've had with folks that say it's not just an issue of under God, but it's really a question of where should we pledge allegiance and make that mandatory at all. So I expect that there is some tension under that. So that's kind of the first area and the subplot. The second question is kind of framed in how we did the title. Whom do we really pledge our lives or allegiance to? I mean, really, as people and as a nation, who is it that we pledge our lives and our allegiance to? God or our country? Can there, is there conflict between the two, especially in light of the current wave of patriotism combined with God Bless America related to September 11th? So that's kind of the second major theme is, whom do we really pledge our allegiance to? Who is it that owns our soul? The subplot to that question, I think, is in light of the response to 9/11, is can we be with God and the United States at the same time? And that was framed in a Vespers for me a couple of weeks ago by Steve McClellan, who had recently was, and I think I got his last name wrong, was recently released from prison. He is an activist and very much against the use of violence in any way, shape, or form. And he had a line in that Vespers that created a lot of tension in the village, and it was simply this: you're either with George W. or you're with God. And in this situation, you can't be with both. So we had a fair amount of great discussion. So that's kind of the subplot to that. The third major question that has come up is, you know, what does it mean to be patriotic? And the reason that we chose this theme tonight on the eve of the 4th of July is that tomorrow is about a lot of frivolity here in the village. And that's a big part of who Holden is, a very big part. But at the same time, we want it to be a part of we want Holden to be a place of substance. And so the question, that, as I've talked to many of you, is can we be patriotic and critical of our country at the same time? So anyway, I lay those questions out to kind of frame what I think the conversation is. And then I'm just going to tell you a little bit about my thoughts on this. I was privileged when I was at Holden Village. Well, first of all, I grew up in Boise, Idaho. I went second grade through college in Boise, Idaho. And I grew up in a pretty blue-collar family. I was the first person in my family to go to college. And my father was a lifelong, worked for the telephone company his entire life. All of his friends and relationships were the telephone company. And so I give you that a sense from kind of from whence I came. I mean, I'm from Idaho. You know, I thought John Wayne was my hero, and in the United States, we always wore the white hats, and we were never wrong. So that was my life, and that was my kind of history, and that was the culture and the community and the society in which I lived. Then I came here. In 1989, I was privileged to be invited by the Mennonite Central Committee to spend a month in El Salvador. And Jackie Brolsma, who was the program coordinator, and myself were invited. Barry Shelley, a former staff program coordinator, was the primary staff person for the Mennonite Central Community, Central Committee. And we were invited to come to El Salvador. And I thought this would be great because I'd only been to Victoria, Canada in my life. So we spent a month in El Salvador. At that time, there were travel warnings against United States citizens going to El Salvador. In that year, El Salvador was only second in aid to Israel from the United States. And I had the opportunity to meet with all of the workers and the Mennonite workers there. And the reason for us being there was that as these workers returned to the United States in their homes from El Salvador, that they were having trouble re-entering American society. And they wanted them to have friends and people there that understood who and what they were about and what they were doing. I was fortunate, Jackie and I were fortunate, that we were invited to go into the war zone. I'm not very bright. And we had to leave in the middle of the night, and we had to cross two guarded bridges, and then the road ran out, and then we walked about 2 miles into a little village and mistook all night. We left at 2 a.m. And so it's one of those nights where you don't get any sleep, and we get in this little village, and they're cooking up tortillas for us, and then we slept on straw mats on the ground. And I was exhausted. I was totally exhausted. And then in a village about 2 miles away from us was a bombing run. American jets flown by Salvadoran army bombing this village. Now, you'd think I'd be upset about that, but I was actually so tired, I was just annoyed. And I thought, don't those people know I'm trying to get a nap here? It was like being in a different world at a different time. And the next day, we went to that village because this village had been resettled a year previous. At that point about 70,000 refugees, Salvadoran refugees from Honduras, who had marched back into the country to reclaim their land. And this was the 1 year anniversary of this village and this community. And it was kind of cool because we went to this plaza. And first of all, we found out in the bombing run that what had occurred was that the bombs had killed one cow and injured a young girl. And that had been the extent of the damage. But people were coming from everywhere for this mass that was going to occur. And it was this typical Spanish town with a courtyard, and the roof was blown off the church. And two priests who were forbidden to be there by the government had come from San Salvador to conduct this high mass. And of course, I didn't know any Spanish, so I sat up on the stairs of the church and smoked my pipe. I smoke a pipe. And the kids of El Salvador loved that. They called me El Pipo. And so during mass, all the kids are around me. But later, I got to meet the two priests that were there. Now, the other thing I got to do while I was there was live on the dump in San Salvador. And literally, this dump is called the April 22nd community. And there were 10,000 people living on this dump. And they had put little houses together out of tin and cardboard. And at that point, the only money that was coming in was from Catholic Charities USA. And they had erected a little church there. And we stayed with the Catholic priest there. At the end of my visit, I had seen a lot of things that had confused a person from Idaho. So I asked my friend Barry that I wanted to go to the American Embassy. And I wanted to talk to the American Embassy about what I had seen and what I experienced. So I went to the American Embassy, and they set up a meeting with the associate consul, whatever that person was. And one of the questions I asked, because of the huge amount of aid that Salvador was receiving from the United States, half of it was to be given for domestic reasons. And I asked where that money went. I hadn't seen any of that money. I mean, on every corner in San Salvador was 18-year-olds holding automatic weapons, which, believe me, drives down the crime rate. And but I had seen no domestic relief. And the lady, the associate consul, said, well, we have a list. We'll give you that when we leave. And I said, well, just give me an example. I just want one example. And she said, the April 22nd committee. And I said, I just spent 3 days and two nights in that community, and there's no U.S. aid coming in there. And she stared at me and she said, I am so tired of you leftist church workers. And, you know, this is the end of my visit, and I looked up and I said, lady, I'm from Idaho. There are no leftists in Idaho. Believe me, there are damn few church workers. And, of course, I came back to tell my story. And I, one of the things, I went to churches, and people started to call me a communist. So that's just my experience there. And then the second experience that I would just say is that I think I'm probably one of the few people in the United States, if not the world, who didn't hear about 9/11 until 9/14. I was on a horseback trip in the Flat Tops Wilderness of Colorado and came out on September 14th. And we're packing our horses up, and a rancher lady rode her horse up, and she visited where you've always been. There were seven of us, and we talked for a while, and then she said, you guys don't have a clue, dude. You don't have a clue. And then she told us this story. And frankly, I didn't really believe it. I mean, this was just too bizarre to believe. And the cell phone doesn't work in my car, because I'm still halfway in the wilderness, and so I drive to a mountain above Steamboat Springs, and I'm able to get a hold of my wife and get some news, and I got to say, God bless NPR. And as I drove to Saratoga, Wyoming, and spent the night, and you know, across desolate Wyoming, you can get NPR across that, almost that whole state. But this is what I was struck by now, 3 days later, because I missed all the other 9/11 stuff, so it was all the aftermath. Was the wave of patriotism and the God bless America. God bless America. And for some reason, and I don't know why, I just kept saying, where is a voice that's going to say, God bless the world? God bless all of creation. I mean, right now it seems we need a word of God bless the world. And what we're getting is a word of God bless America. So, anyway, those are reflections of mine on the pledge. I'm going to introduce Dale. Dale is a retired school teacher, and I thought no one could be better to talk about the Pledge of Allegiance than somebody who's been doing it for most of their life.
Well, yes, I am a retired school teacher, and but right now my feelings are right here because I'm not exactly sure the feelings that I'm feeling amongst the setting here. And I'm going to talk to the point that the decision was the right decision. And in order to do that, I think I need to take this is a role that I've taken frequently in my life, which is the devil's advocate role. And I'm going to do this in a little different way, and hopefully, because I'm feeling a little jealous for the popcorn and the ice cream that I missed. So what I'm going to ask you to do first is to turn to your neighbor and tell your neighbor when the last time that you said the Pledge of Allegiance. Could you do that? Just turn to your neighbor and tell your neighbor, when did you say the Pledge of Allegiance?
Thank you.
give you a couple numbers and just kind of think back in your mind, how many times did you say the Pledge of Allegiance? And based on your conversation, which he promised me would not come off my time, I can tell that, you know, you do recall when you said the Pledge of Allegiance in the setting that it took place. Now I'm going to ask you, how many times in your life can you think that you have said the Pledge of Allegiance? So we'll just start off with 200. 250. You've said it 250 times?
No.
Okay. You said it at least 250 times. All right. So now how about 500? Now keep your hand up if you're 500. 750. And if I get to your number and you don't think you've said it that many times, and put your hand down. 750. 1,000. 1,250. 1,500. 2003. Well, how many people think they're in a year? Yeah. So, now let me switch this. I'm not going to ask you when you said the Lord's Prayer last, but how many times have you said it? 250? 500?
But not as many times.
Not as many times. 1,000? 1,500? 2,000, 3,000. Okay, so the point that I'm trying to make is that for some people, these are just words. And that's what they become. They become just words. And I won't take the time to go around and try to find out why you might have said this 3,000 times. But you got the message over there in the corner when you said, when one person said, as a teacher, how many times do teachers say this? So I taught for 33 years, plus, you know, my other part as a student, which we've all kind of gone through. So I've said it many, many times. Well, I have two children. One is a son. And I tried the Lord's Prayer, and I tried the Creed, and I tried these other things. The more I tried to get him to repeat it, the more atheistic he became. Just going back again, in my generation, confirmation was memorization of Scripture, repeating that, and other things that we memorize. And if I memorized it, then I made it, I guess, someplace. The point I'm trying to make is, at least at this one point I'm trying to make is, to me, there's no connection. There's no meaning, and without meaning, there's no respect. There's no, I do love this country, and I'm willing to die for it. Okay? So one of the points that I'm trying to make is that if it becomes this routine thing that I say every day in my classroom, and I make your kids say it, because if they don't say it, I may send them to the principal. What they may do, but anyway, you get the message, right? You get the point. My second point is that as a teacher, I'm mandated by oath to say this thing, irregardless of my own individual belief system, the country that I may have come from, the country my ancestors may have come from. So each time I say this, I may also be saying to myself, what a hypocrite you are. Because you're standing up here in front of these kids, trying to tell these kids this is what you believe. So one of my choices is, as a teacher, I'm not going to do it. And then what? Well, I could be reported. And then I have a conference with an administrator. And then it goes in my file. And then, and then, and then. So as a teacher, I have difficulty with an oath. I also had to sign an oath, be fingerprinted and the other things in the state of California to be a teacher. And it was, I mean, so I had no choice. at least I was told, if you don't sign it, you don't get the teacher contract. It's part of the requirement. I'm not so sure if they were bluffing. I, at that time in my life, I did not choose to take them up on a bluff. Another point that I have, at least to me, is separation of church and state. So where do we draw the line? So when I'm required to say this pledge, then am I bringing in an element under God? Who's God? Your God? My God? The belief systems that I have in my classroom, if I allow them to be spoken, are like awesome. They come from, you know, it doesn't look like this. All I can tell you, it doesn't look like the school that I went to. It is different. The languages that the kids speak. I was just thinking about this earlier. What would it be like to say a Pledge of Allegiance in Spanish? Because that's what 90% of my kids are. I taught at the high school level, so they, you know, most of my kids spoke English. But there were often times when I said the Pledge of Allegiance by myself. They didn't say it. And it wasn't as quiet as it is in here right now. Because they just kept, you know, I would say the Pledge of Allegiance and they just keep talking about, you know, what was happening today. But I would go through the routine of saying, all rise and do, you know. Sometimes when I finished the Pledge of Allegiance, I said under my breath, amen. Another point, I call it moral character. And then I wrote down, you can't make me believe it just because I say it. So, and as a teacher, I think moral character is very important. Now the question I have is, who's supposed to teach this? I had kind of like a lot of different hats, as I wear this one. And people sometimes wonder what does this mean? Again, the question is, so who's supposed to teach it? The family? Well, at least the kids that I worked with, when I looked at their family structure, oftentimes there wasn't one. I started off teaching science and math, and then science teachers were supposed to teach sex education through biology, and it didn't quite work. And then I got into counseling, and so I did a lot of work with the families. But then it became, the family didn't talk about sex education. That's why I was the sex man on campus. You know, so sometimes it would be like, I'd have to have a counseling session on, okay, here's an empty chair, and how do we talk to mom about, yeah, I'm pregnant. So again, I question who is to teach this moral character. Then it becomes schools, all right? So then it becomes, what character am I going to teach about? What story? What faith? What system? And then I come to the third one I had here, was the church. And to me, again, here's the devil's advocate, but there's a void. I'm not so sure that the church is really doing moral character. I hear a lot of top-down stuff, but I don't see a lot of the stuff here between people. And I guess then the last one is, whose country is under God? And then I kind of look at, again, this League of Nations that I teach to. And I have conversations with my son about this same issue. About, okay, Dad, there is another side to 9/11. It's not just our side. There are reasons why people are doing this. And we need to look at those reasons. So, again, trying to take the devil's advocate here, I'm not so sure if it just, by leaving it in, if we just don't perpetuate the hypocrisy that I continue to see. Thanks.
Thanks, Tim. Eric?
Well, Ken asked me to look at the opinion and take the position that the opinion won't withstand scrutiny. And so what I want to do is just explain, if I can, a little bit about what the judges were writing about. I've been up here, so I haven't had a chance to read the opinion, so I've just read the articles, but I think I have a decent understanding because I've dealt with some issues like this before. Let me just give a little bit of background. Image is the Ninth Circuit. Our nation is divided up into 12 different circuits. And the Ninth Circuit is California, Oregon, Washington, and a few other states, some that don't count. And it is known as a very liberal circuit because, as you might imagine, most of the judges come out of California, and California tends to be liberal, and many of the movements in the country's law have come from Ninth Circuit. It also happens to be the circuit that is most often overturned by our Supreme Court. That's just background. But this is one of those areas that if somebody said to me, hey, the Pledge of Allegiance has been declared unconstitutional, I would have said Ninth Circuit did it. What happened is you have a three-judge, when it's at this level, there's three judges that hear the argument. And here there was an atheist father arguing on his own, didn't have a lawyer involved, arguing that it was unconstitutional. Two of the judges agreed and found it unconstitutional. One of the judges on the three-judge panel disagreed and dissented, said, no, that's wrong. But 2-1, the opinion was held. Immediately, the judge that wrote the decision, Ed Goodwin, who is a very fine judge, he's been a judge a long time, I've argued in front of him, and I know him, and I respect him greatly, he immediately stayed his ruling, meaning that even though he ruled it unconstitutional, if a school was in session, which is not in June, they didn't have to apply. So you can still do the Pledge of Allegiance even today in the Ninth Circuit. But what he ruled was, he took a look at the history of law in this area, and he said that adding God in 1954, which was mentioned before, conveys, quote, a message of state endorsement of religious belief. And so he takes that to get to, it violates the constitutional wall separating church and state. And ultimately, he concluded that you have a publicly paid instructor at a publicly paid funded school, and this endorses faith in God. And that's wrong under the Constitution. So that ruling came out. Within hours, he then stayed it, saying it doesn't have to be enforced, because it was immediately appealed, and in any of the circuit courts, federal courts, you can appeal to the entire circuit. And then they give you 11 judges who would then hear the same argument, or hear arguments again, and they can, within the circuit itself, flip it or overturn that. If the 11 judges don't have to hear that, they're going to hear this one. If they agree that this is unconstitutional, and if 6-5 would be fine, then the next level would be go to our U.S. Supreme Court. So that is what's happening right now, is it's going, the petitions are being made to this 11-member panel. They will likely hear it in a fairly short order. So what I want to do today is talk about what challenges are going to be made, what arguments are going to be made, and why I think that it likely will be flipped by the 11-member panel and almost certainly will be flipped by the U.S. Supreme Court. Now, I want to differentiate that we're talking about legal issues here, and the discussion I want to get into moral and these other issues, but right now we're just saying we are a country that is governed by law, and we have a constitution. And so that's what any issue like this would have to start with, the Constitution. It may surprise some of you that if you read the Constitution and all of the amendments, you will never see the word separation of church and state. It doesn't appear anywhere. Where it comes from is the First Amendment that prohibits supporting an official established church. When the First Amendment was made, everybody had in mind the Anglican Church. You couldn't create a governmental church. That's what it meant. And so over time, as our Constitution has evolved, it's a living document, it has been interpreted the Establishment Clause. The Establishment Clause by itself means the Anglican Church, most would argue. But that has now changed starting in 1971 when the court, as opposed, and I'm talking about the U.S. Supreme Court now, as some would say the U.S. Supreme Court is conservative now, in the 70s it was more liberal. In the 70s they expanded the Establishment Clause and started to use it to invalidate things if it coerced or endorsed religious faith. That's not what the First Amendment says, but that's how they interpreted it in the 70s. And so they then used that, and I'm sure many of you remember, they invalidated prayers in church. Even if you, or I'm sorry. In
I think that's just going too far. Okay.
That's the next session. So what they did is there was a test case that ran through, and it was a prayer in the South that you weren't forced to say. But the Supreme Court said, you know what, when a teacher is leading a prayer, even if you're not forced to say it, that's coercion, it's endorsement of faith, and we're not going to allow that in the schools. So then the next test case that ran through was the invocation at a Texas football game. The captain of the football team went in there and led a prayer before the teams kicked off. School wasn't involved. Still, the Supreme Court said, no, that you're allowing that, that's coercion, it's endorsement of faith. So people thought that the U.S. Supreme Court was actually going to start going farther down that road. But what was happening on a different line was a line of patriotism cases. And that's the line that you'll be hearing a whole lot about if you pay much attention to what's going to happen now. Because what the court was saying there, and these are the same judges, but different cases. And they're saying there that if it is, that they will not disturb references to God that have been woven into the fabric of our national life. And what they do is they view it as ceremonial. And therefore, it's not an establishment of religion. And what the court can do, of course, is start using the Establishment Clause in the prayer cases and saying it's coercion, and then go back to the text of the First Amendment and say, look, this is patriotism, it's not establishment, therefore we're not going to go down that road. And so you have a separate line of cases that led to, in 1963, Justice Brennan, who was a very liberal justice, but he wrote that, and again I'm quoting, the patriotic exercises that no longer have a religious purpose or meaning are not unconstitutional. And that is why you will find one of the hardest arguments to be made at the next level is the Pledge of Allegiance more like a prayer or is it a patriotic exclamation? And that is really the battle line, because if you can ebb it over to the prayer, which is really what the ruling was by Judge Goodwin, then you're going to get in this line of cases that says you can't do that. If you're going to say pledge is really just patriotism, you're going to go over to the patriotism line of cases, and then it's going to be found to be ceremonial and without meaning. So we agree. And this is one of the reasons it's kind of fun to talk about in this setting is I'm saying that the decision will be overturned, but not because I think the judges are going to say no, we have to keep under God in the pledge. They're going to say that doesn't mean anything. So therefore, it's not an establishment of religion. So. And I haven't been able to read any of the pundits yet, but another huge aspect that any issue like this has on both the Ninth Circuit at the Supreme Court level is, what is the effect of this? If this ruling comes out and stands, what precedent does this set? And if you all take out a quarter or a penny, what's it say?
You trust.
And how many of us start our school days or scouts or whatever else with either America the Beautiful or God Bless America? And so what it is likely to happen is the 11 members Circuit Court is going to, in their chambers, talk about, all right, we understand that Judge Goodwin was sending a message, and we can't fault him. If you slide this over to the prayer side, there is precedent for this. But if you look at it as a patriotic side, and that what else has to happen, because I don't know if you've seen, but apparently the plaintiff in this case is going on Good Morning America and everywhere else saying, we've got to eliminate the word God from everything that is said or supported by the public. And that, again, gets back to what our country was based on. I mean, the Declaration of Independence is based on God. Now, we can say, well, it's just a meaningless thing now, but the courts are very reluctant to start down that road. And this firmly starts you down that road unless you find it's a prayer. That, you've got a box. If you can fit it in the prayer, the Supreme Court has said, you can't do that. Everything you put in that box doesn't have any other repercussions. I think it's going to be really hard to fit this one in that box. Now, the day after the Ninth Circuit issued this ruling, the Supreme Court came out with its first ruling on the Establishment Clause for quite a while. In Cleveland, Ohio, they initiated a voucher program that they were going to give kids $2,500 to either give to the public school of their choice or any private school of their choice. Well, it so happens that in Cleveland, Ohio, your choices are go to public school or go to parochial school. Now, Catholic, Jewish, there's several parochial schools, but it's either religious or it's public. And so it was a test case. The voucher system, President Bush has been trying to push this and been getting nowhere. And perfect test case, the law is written, the voucher program is written, was completely neutral. You can use the $2,500 for any public private school of your choice. But in reality, it meant either religious or public. And the Supreme Court, in a 5-4 decision, meaning that of the 9, only 5 went this way with 4 dissents, again, which just shows you there's no meeting of the minds in any of these issues, they said that's just fine. They said that because it is written in a neutral way, we will not find this unconstitutional. Now, if that's, in my opinion, that's a very strong signal from this court that they're not going to continue using that Establishment Clause to push farther. They like the box that they've set up. If you can fit in that box, you're fine. If you can't fit in that box, they're not going to go down that road. And so I think what will happen here is, again, just looking at it from a legal point of view, you will find that the 11-member panel will find this as a patriotic ceremonial. They will find that it no longer has religious meaning or purpose, and therefore it is not a violation of the Establishment Clause, and they'll flip it so that the Supreme Court will never even have to address this issue. And it is highly unlikely that if the Ninth Circuit, being the liberal one that it is, reverses itself on this, that any of the other circuits would step out and say, well, we're going to take this anyway. It is a situation that a Supreme Court normally doesn't get involved in these kinds of issues unless it's a major constitutional issue, which this one obviously would be. I guess my last thoughts on this is, it is, I think, very important for all of us to take this opportunity to hopefully understand a little bit about what our law is made on, because the Constitution is something we should all understand. And I think it is important as Christians or believers that we understand what that document says and what it doesn't say, and that we then take it to the next level and talk about the moral implications. What does it mean? What does the pledge say? What do we want to do with that as believers? And how can we make it meaningful, not by having everybody have to stand up and potentially say it in school, but by going beyond that? And that's what I hope we can talk about today.
Hey, sir.
I have a question about the legal thing. Part of what I was wondering about on this is the idea that being mandated in schools, regardless of if it's a prayer or a meaningless ceremony, can you mandate, under the Constitution, can you mandate patriotism in that way as well?
Well, I think it was 48, the Supreme Court has already ruled that you can't force someone to say the Pledge of Allegiance. And so it's not mandated in the sense that you have to say it. And I guess my response is you can't, I'm not aware of anything that can mandate patriotism, although the flag burning, there's certainly issues.
The contract.
Well, that's what, that's part of my point is that I can be mandated to say it as a condition, but the kids don't have to say it.
Right.
And what does that say?
That stand a constitutional challenge. Mandate that. Well, I wonder if that would stand. I don't see how it could possibly. It is, there are many employment decisions out there that say you're free to take a job or not take a job. And as long as
working for the government.
As long as the conditions are set before you start, and it's, he's, I think the argument would be that he is leading it as part of a government worker.
I think I think the ruling in 1943 was that you can't make kids say the pledge. Didn't address the issue of whether the employer can make the teacher say the pledge.
Jehovah's Witnesses don't say the pledge.
Right.
So you can't make kids, but with teachers, I don't think that was addressed in 43.
Well, I was going to ask another question about possible legal response to well, let's imagine this one. You know, we've got the atheist who says, I don't want my son to say the Pledge of Allegiance because it's forces him to adopt the religious creed. Yes, what if you had a religious body saying we want the phrase under God removed from the Pledge of Allegiance because it doesn't mean anything, it undermines the integrity of religious devotion? What would be the legal response to that?
If you look at the background of where the phrase came, and you actually back up, you'll often find God inserted into these more patriotic times in a time of national crisis. And In God We Trust in the coins, guess when that was put on the coins for the first time? Right after the Civil War.
Interestingly, money is loaned without grace. Do you know that? Anytime you sign a loan, one of the legal phrases is it is loaned to you without grace.
Dwayne, go ahead.
The answer to his point is that's a political idea. That's a political decision. That's not a constitutional decision.
That's our whole point.
And that's where I was going to is that what your question is really a political question, as opposed to a constitutional or legal question. And that's why I was getting back to the times that the God has been added, or both in after the Civil War and then in 1954, we wanted to show that we're a God-fearing nation. These were political decisions. And then once the political decision is made, then you doesn't withstand a constitutional challenge. But your question is a political question, and that would be for Congress. It would be for somebody to bring to Congress, which they may do now, and ask them to remove under God, which then there would be debates from the senators and the House, and they'd make. But there wouldn't be there'd be no legal challenge to that, because the Constitution doesn't say you can have it or not, whether it's meaningful or not.
I just want to ask a question. We're going to go for another 20-25 minutes, and then we'll break. And if there's still folks that want to stay around and visit, we'll do that as well, but we'll bring it to a close. But this is our chance to talk, but I want to just try to get a feel for the group as a whole. So I'm going to ask a series of questions, and you have to raise your hand. And if you don't raise your hand, you got to step up the plate here. If you don't step up the plate, then I've got a third question that I'll categorize you as. The first question, just a feel in the room, is how many people think under God should be eliminated from the Pledge of Allegiance? Raise your hands high. How many people do not believe under God should be eliminated? Okay, and those who didn't raise their hands must not believe anything. There we go. Or believes the last person who spoke. Now, my sense of the room was it was about 50-50. Now, I just want to ask another question related, that was about the under God. How many people in this room believe the Pledge of Allegiance should be eliminated?
From you, from where?
From use, school use, any use. So maybe eighth of the people in the room. So, interesting. Okay, this is a chance for us to talk amongst ourselves and with each other, and so comments, reflections.
Do other countries have a similar pledge?
No.
Does anyone know? I don't know.
We were at a group in Canada, and every time the word Our Queen was mentioned, they leaped to their feet. Now, I don't think they crossed their heart and said anything, but in general conversation, whenever they said, and the Queen, these people stood.
They, you know, all countries have national anthems that are used in the same kind of sense of a political allegiance to their country, and it's not you know, they're all sung in music, but I think it has the same kind of purpose.
Do folks know of other countries that have a creed or a?
Well, I was just going to say, Germany is actually, they're very kind of, they don't identify with the flag of Germany at all. And in fact, I don't think people really know the anthem.
Not at the Olympics.
Yeah, they don't really, they identify as Europeans. They're very anti-nationalistic in their history.
Well, no, because they said Heil Hitler for years, and that was not considered.
Well, the people of the younger generation now. Like,
oh, I know. That's why. Right. That's why. Right.
So.
But, Becky.
Well, as a high school teacher, I appreciate having the Pledge of Allegiance said in class because it stimulates a lot of interesting discussion. In my high school, students are given the opportunities to abstain from standing and seeing it if they choose not to. That alone oftentimes will stimulate good discussion. And it also a lot of times can spawn good discussion about what the words allegiance means and what it means to say that you're pledging to something for something that stands for something. It may not be, it may not have come to fruition, but it's an ideal. And I like the mix that happens when you do that in a public high school.
Peggy.
Well, you've got more than one subject being discussed, obviously, the under God or the pledge itself. I'm just thinking of one place I see the pledge used. In our county in south of Washington, we have lots of refugees coming. And at the moment, the biggest bulk of them are from the Ukraine. And they are so thrilled to be in a country where they're free. They are so proud of things that can happen here that most of the rest of us have really taken for granted, and although I hopefully we all value it, but when in our church they have classes, English as a second language and citizenship classes, and I'll tell you, it's pretty darn moving to walk through that room with all these people that look like Russian peasants to me. They still wear their little babushkas and they have beautiful children, by the way. Gosh, you should see the gorgeous children, up to eight, and lots of kids. When they say the Pledge of Allegiance, they are speaking out of their heart that they are proud that they are in this country. And that's very moving. I wouldn't like that taken away from me.
Well, I think you zero in on me that we're pledging allegiance to the flag. You've got to remember the next, what it says next.
Do we pledge allegiance to the flag?
Is it the flag? Yes.
Yes. Yes. And to the republic for which it stands. And so thusly, it is a symbol of our country. So I never really thought of the flag. Yes, I'm proud of the flag, but I'm pledging allegiance to my country. Am I not? Isn't that what it says?
Yes.
It has nothing in a sense to do with the flag other than the flag is the symbol. Now, who in here objects to pledging allegiance to the country, our republic?
The objections I have are several, and one is theological. I think we're presently treading very dangerous theological ground when our head of state characterizes us as the good people fighting a war against evil people. I mean, that is terribly dangerous theologically. forget morality. Throw morality out. I mean, even if you think those guys are the epitome of evil, if you say that there's no evil in you, you're not Christian. It just doesn't
fit. I haven't said that.
Yeah. Well, but the president is. The president is very explicit in saying that. And I think because he has, we need to give serious attention to the language we use and to the way we cultivate patriotism. And right now, I just think it's dangerous to pledge allegiance to the flag using that phrase under God, given the fact that we're in a climate which characterizes this nation as the only nation under God seeking truth, and the other nations against which we're at war as those which are godless and are not seeking truth.
I don't see that at all. I don't see us claiming the high ground of being the only country out there seeking good. And also, I think the term, there's been a lot of rhetoric around evildoers, and actually I think it's not saying they're evil, it's saying the people that did an evil act. So maybe that's a small difference, but I don't know if we're characterizing them as evil.
That is not what the president said.
He calls them evildoers.
Yes.
He calls them doers of evil.
This is a war of good versus evil. We're engaged in a war with
an
axis of evil. Yes. I mean, it's more than saying, they made a mistake.
Okay. This is good. We're actually having intelligent conversations. So, if you want to speak, raise your hand. I'll acknowledge you.
I think the faith issue is the one of do I blindly do anything? Do I ever give up the requirement that I make choices, and I've taken an oath of office to support, uphold, and defend the Constitution of the United States, et cetera. That's very different to me. There's a line between that and swearing allegiance to. And once I've sworn allegiance to, I've begun to give up in my own mind some choice making, some rational thinking processes I need to make as I take action. Those are critical boundaries that I'm using language. I'm trying to be as precise as I can with language. And so while I have sworn to uphold some things, I haven't taken this allegiance to an entity which I can't always control.
I don't think
it's meant to be a blind allegiance, not the way I see it. I mean, we have a constitution, and that allegiance is to the constitution. And if we feel like, the founding of our country, if we feel like there are things that we don't agree with, then we have a forum in which to take and create change and help direct and shape a direction of the nation. And that's what our allegiance should be to.
Go in the very far back and then to Dwayne.
Having served in the U.S. military, I understand oaths, and I've made them myself, and it's a standing rule, it always has been acted on, that if you get an order that's unlawful by your lawful authority, you have the right to object and to not obey that order. I think any time we abrogate, whether we oath, allegiance, or otherwise, we abrogate our intelligence, our ability to think about what we're doing, we're making the wrong step, and we're making the step that countries have made in the past where they ask for and receive blind allegiance to anything. But by the same token, you have to stand for something at some point. And when you do that with the intelligence to know that I'm the thinking, rational person, that if I see things going wrong, this democracy, this republic that we have, offers us the opportunity to speak our minds and to change the way things are. Not to blindly follow where they are, whether it's George W. or anybody else, but to have the opportunity to change by acting. And you can see, unfortunately, by the fact that we have the right and the privilege and don't exercise it when we can get only 52% of the United States citizens in this country to vote on the presidential election. You have people coming from Ukraine, and you have people in India and other democracies where the typical turnout is 80%. There's where the problem lies. It's not with blind allegiance, it's the fact that people don't involve and engage themselves in a process that was established a long time ago that offers us the freedom, the right, and the privilege to change the way things are if we don't think they're right, whether they be governmental leaders or governmental processes.
Dwayne?
He said the same thing that I was
Come in the back here.
I was just going to say that I agree too, that when I think of allegiance, I'm one who didn't vote whether we should have the Pledge of Allegiance or not, because I'm not certain whether it's that important. But I do think that, you know, loyalty to this country and for what it stands for is important. So if the pledge is something that represents that, I would not ever think in my own mind or want to teach children that means you're pledging allegiance to a particular president's declarations of what that president thinks is right or wrong or evil or not. What I would want to teach children or declare myself is an allegiance to fundamental freedom and some of the good established laws that we have in this country, that we have refugees coming, and that we so there are things that I think that we can be loyal to, whether we do it through a pledge or in other forms. I think that it is worthy for us to be advocating those kind of positive things, whether they're being lived out or not in present leadership is very questionable, and that's what our privilege is to question that. And that is what I want to be loyal to. I mean, I want to pledge allegiance to a place where we can criticize, where we can criticize loudly, protest, whatever, and that is something to feel loyal towards.
Okay, I'm going to throw some fire on the water. Is there oil on the fire? I told you the story about being in El Salvador and attending this mass with the two Catholic priests that weren't supposed to be there from San Salvador. After I returned to the United States, the Salvadoran army, paid for by the United States, and the officers trained at the School of Americas, busted into the seminary, executed seven Catholic priests, the housekeeper and their daughter, and the two priests that I had met. I wasn't proud of this.
You think that was an isolated act?
No. And so that's what's, I struggle then with that issue in terms of, again, what might be the blind, what I'm afraid is the blind allegiance. And I started out my remarks by saying I thought we were always right, and I'm finding more and more that we're not right, and that we don't talk about that.
You're absolutely right. We've made some decisions as a government in the past that were black and white. The communists were bad, we were good. Today it's the evildoers are bad, we're good. And in some cases, in many cases, foreign policy was executed on a much too simplistic basis. We then went into a period of time, a short period of time before 9/11, where we said, we're not going to be engaged. And George W. and others said, we can't figure out what's going on in the Middle East, haven't been able to, don't want to get tangled up into it. As George Washington warned us in his farewell address, beware of foreign entanglements, because you're going to get in a lot of trouble when you do. And yet, we couldn't avoid our responsibility as the only, quote, remaining superpower to be involved. So we often, as a nation, can't decide what the right thing to do is, to not be engaged, to be engaged, and to be engaged in what measure. And it's very difficult when we exercise foreign aid with a foreign government. We think we're doing the right thing, supporting a fight against communists. We train people in a way we think to fight, but you know what? That control disappears once it goes into that country. No matter how powerful we think we are, we cannot extend control of that foreign aid all the way down to the user. It probably should be that way. It should be better, and we should hold our government more accountable. But I again raise the question of how many people really care, A, about what happens outside the shores of the United States, and B, are willing to stand up and be represented in a representative democracy in a way that can affect change to those policies.
I hear you talking about what really is a very positive way to be patriotic.
That's the way I've always been raised and thought.
To be very much engaged in that way, whether you're for or against, however, and because there's commitment there.
There's one back here.
Yeah, I just want to challenge the suggestion that one can be patriotic in that way right now in America. And I think part of the problem is with our is what we understand patriotism to be. I would suggest that going into the assistant consular office in El Salvador at that time and challenging the U.S. policy is a way of being patriotic. I think I don't know very many, for example, civic groups where you could stand up and challenge the decisions made by George W. Bush and have those welcomed. I mean, there's a lot of examples of people trying to be patriotic in that way, challenging that, and having a real hard time. And I think we talk about this being a country where you're free to do that, and I think legally we are free to do that. But we certainly don't have an environment civically where one can challenge the kinds of things that are going on. I would say that Holden Village is a pretty safe place for that kind of thing, but there are not a whole lot of other places where you can be patriotic in that way. So I would say legally we have that freedom, but you know, if you were a member of Congress, it would be absolute political suicide to challenge what's going on militarily in the United States. One other quick thing I would say, and that is the irony of this politically, and that is that this is likely to be overturned because the phrase under God means nothing, but the very people who will celebrate that are those people who believe that those words mean the God who is incarnate in Jesus Christ. So politically, it is a victory for those who are very sectarian in their understanding of religion, but that decision was decided because it means nothing. And I find it very ironic.
I find it interesting that we have decided that, or apparently, we are naming George W. Bush, who is our elected president. And I certainly don't agree with everything that he has done, nor do I agree with a lot of things other presidents have done. But yet, he has been elected. He is our leader. We have influence on him through the election process. We can take care of him next election. Hopefully. And I also hear or feel, I spent 31 years in the military. And I was charged with doing some things that I would rather not have done. I never, I dropped some 500,000 pounds of bombs on in Cambodia. Many times, on many occasions, I wish I had not had to do that. But I was sworn, you mentioned that we, as an officer in the Air Force, Army, whatever, we swore to uphold and support the Constitution. We did not swear to support George W. Bush in any way, shape, or form. The Constitution is what we held our hand up and said we will defend and support. And I will just close with, I heard someone mentioned Hitler. One of the smartest things that Hitler ever did, and we've got to guard against this very carefully, Hitler had every officer in the military swear allegiance to him. Him personally. Not the Constitution, not to Germany, but to him. We don't do that in this country. We swear allegiance to uphold the Constitution.
I see absolutely nothing wrong with that, even though there are political leaders that do things that certainly I wouldn't do.
Okay, I am going to honor our commitment of time. We're actually up and out of time. We're going to take a break. We're going to let folks leave, but then also the invitation for folks to gather close around the fireplace and do. But first of all, would you all thank Dale and Eric for just thanks for being willing to come to Holden Village and have intelligent conversation.